What's going on, everybody? This is Black Men Sundays. I'm your host, Corey Sylvester Murray, and we're talking about generational wealth, finance, business, and of course, mental health.
It's a Black Men Sunday. Time to put all childish things away. I refuse to be the man I was yesterday. Gotta put my best foot forward and elevate.
And before we introduce today's guest, my brother Eric from Nashville, aka Nash Vegas, who do you have for our Black Men Sunday spotlight, my brother?
Hey, man, thanks a lot for the warm introduction, Corey. Man, you know, back in the day, we used to, you know, you and I come from humble beginnings where we worked in broadcast television. So I thought this was kind of a tribute to some of the things we used to do. When we used to gather news stories, we had a common friend. His name was Captain Al. He was a helicopter pilot back in the day that did our aerials and stuff when we had to cover newsworthy stories. So this is something that was kind of, I was kind of doing a little research, and this is something that, because technology is always evolving, so I want to share this story about this young brother, man. His name is Willie Techman Jenkins. He's an African-American inventor who pioneered the drone technology that we see today. A lot of people don't know this, so I'm going to share some facts with you. Now, despite his groundbreaking contributions, Jenkins' achievements was buried by the weight of systematic racism that plagued the era, leaving his name and inventions obscured from history. Now, he was born and raised in the vibrant streets of Los Angeles. Jenkins possessed an insatiable curiosity for technology from a young age. With ingenuity and determination, he tirelessly worked toward his vision by creating unmanned serial vehicles that revolutionized various industries. Jenkins' breakthrough came through in 1982. So this drone technology has actually been out since 1982, when he unveiled his very first working drone, making it a significant milestone in aviation history. His invention promised unprecedented opportunities in surveillance, aerial photography, and even humanitarian aid. However, amidst the backdrop of racial prejudice, persuasions in the United States, Jenkins faced countless barriers in gaining recognition for his pioneering work. Now, despite his Jenkins encountered hostility and discrimination from the predominantly white-dominated tech industry. Systematic racism barred him from obtaining patents and investment opportunities critical for the widespread adoption of this technology. As a result, his invention remained largely unrecognized. A lot of people don't know this. Like I say, it overshadowed by the achievements of his white counterparts. That's my spotlight for today, Mr. Willie Techman Jenkins. Now back to you. I know a lot of people didn't know this, but them drones you see flying around, you credit that man for this.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea, man, because I'm noticing now. I'm noticing now you're seeing a lot more drones in the air than you're seeing choppers these days. So,
absolutely. Because they're efficient, you know. You have to, you know, the fuel that it takes and paying the pilot and the maintenance on the helicopter. I can buy a little $20, $30 drone and fly it around and get a couple of shots and I'm good. That's all you want, you know, just the aerials, you know.
Yeah, man. I feel you, man. Yo, I appreciate that spot, but I had no idea, man. You've been dropping them lately. I see you, man.
Oh, yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for that spotlight, my brother.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to introduce today's guest. We're talking with Justin Grant. This brother is an executive director at J.P. Morgan Chase, Advancing Black Pathways. This brother's also on the board of trustees at Long Island University. That's LIU for y'all in the know. This brother's out of Clinton Hills, Brooklyn, New York. And this brother has worked for leading financial service firms. And he's the author of Company Men, a wellness guide for Black men in corporate America. So without further ado, Justin Grant, welcome to Black Men Sundays, brother. How you doing?
Hey, thank you for having me, my man. I appreciate you.
Definitely, man. And let me tell you, man, I read that book. I read probably the first 100 pages in like an hour. I was like, man, I'm already at over 100. But what's unique about it? But first off, I'm going to let you set the stage. What was the impetus for you writing this book?
Yeah, I appreciate, you know, the intro and the fact that you were able to breeze through it so quickly. You know, one of the things that my journalism school professor, Mike Bush, taught me was keep it simple, student. simple writing. Don't make it hard on your reader, you know. And so I'm glad that you found it to be readable. I went on this journey towards writing this book. It actually started in 2002 when my uncle Juan Simpson, he passed away of a heart attack unexpectedly, over the Christmas holidays. And he had been the chief financial officer for Ethicon Endo Surgery Inc. That's one of Johnson and Johnson's surgical device makers. And so he was up there, and he was on the path to being in the C-suite at the parent company over at J&J. He was my hero. He was covered by Ebony. He'd been interviewed by the New York Times. He was hopping on that corporate jet to go on golf trips to Ireland, right? He was doing things that was just unheard of, for black men. I mean, for anybody in corporate America, it's rare to fly in air that high. And he was doing it as a black man, before we even knew what diversity, equity, and inclusion was, right? So his death, he was fit, he was in shape. So it was a total shock. It wasn't like, he was dealing with anything from a physical standpoint. He was only 48 years old. So I'm at the time, I'm 22, and I'm still in college. I'm about to wrap up at LIU. And 4 years after that, I start working in corporate America. I land my first job as a reporter for Thomson Reuters covering financial markets. And then I'm starting to wonder, like, what was it that my uncle was going through in corporate, right? And I started experiencing some of the stressors of corporate life. And one of the things that I'm looking to drive home with this book is that there's certain stressors to corporate America that are universal to everybody that works in corporate America, right? You're dealing with office politics, palace intrigue. Maybe you don't vibe with certain coworkers, or you're dealing with the micromanaging boss. You're trying to make sure you're getting the right money, negotiating salary. You're dealing with uncertainty, right? We all deal with reorgs and layoffs and the like. But as black men, we have to understand that those stressors that are universal, they might affect us a little bit differently because of all of the things that we're carrying with us into these corporate jobs. And so I'm young corporate, I start that job, and I have this mindset of, man, I gotta make this work, because if this doesn't work, then I'm gonna be right back in my childhood bedroom in my mom's house. I'm trying to build a life for myself. So I'm feeling that pressure. And when things don't always go right, when you face adversity, it can feel a little bit existential when you don't have that safety net to kind of fall back on from a wealth standpoint. So I went through some stressors in corporate, and then I started interviewing brothers that work in corporate America. And I start to hear certain common threads in these stories about how the stress affects their blood pressure, the stress affects their health in certain types of ways. And then on top of that, anecdotally, I'm seeing that, there's a few brothers that I know that have been colleagues in the industry that have, suffered major health crises before the age of 50, right? I just lost a colleague, a managing director, dropped dead, heart ailment, back in January, 45 years old. Another brother that, he lives in my neighborhood. I'm in South Orange, New Jersey, right outside of New York, and not even 40. He has a massive stroke. He's had multiple surgeries on his brain over the past few weeks to stop the bleeding in his brain. There was another brother, industry colleague. He became the first black CIO in the history of his firm. He's like 47, 48 years old. He suffers a massive stroke. So I see these stories happening, and then I'm doing my research, and the research is telling me that black men, the higher we climb the socioeconomic ladder, the greater the likelihood that we're going to suffer from anxiety and depression. And they don't see that trend line in those numbers in any other group, right? This is unique to black men. And when you have anxiety and depression, there's all sorts of downstream effects on the body, right? If you have anxiety or depression, you're not sleeping right. If you're not sleeping right, that throws your blood sugar off. If your blood sugar's off, that could lead to type 2 diabetes, which can also affect your heart. It could lead to gastrointestinal issues when you have anxiety and depression. I lived through that in my first job. I suffered from some gastrointestinal stress, and then that could have some downstream impacts on the body. So I saw all of this stuff happening, and I'm a synthesizer of information. I wanted to tell this story. And I'm pleased to share, Corey, that I heard through a friend of mine, her husband read the book, he goes to the doctor, to get a checkup. The book inspired him to get a checkup because we don't go to the doctor. That's the other thing that I learned. Black men, and look, there's historical reasons why we don't go to the doctor. But anyway, my friend's husband, they take his blood pressure in each arm. So one arm had a blood pressure 20 points higher than the other arm, which meant that there was a blockage somewhere in his body, in his cardiovascular system. They were able to catch something that could have, you know, potentially ended his life because he read this book. So I appreciate, you know, that it's been a bit of a call to action for us to take care of this temple, this body, because we have the second lowest life expectancy.
Wow, yeah, that's great information, man. That ties right in, because on this show we've had plenty of guests come on. They say, listen, health is wealth, you know, versus, you know, spending all your money on medical bills. And I think I read a part of your book where I think it was a quote where it said, eat healthy foods or else you'll be eating your medicine. I'm kind of paraphrasing it, but you know.
Yep, quote Steve Jobs. He said, eat your food as medicine so you don't have to eat medicine as your food. And I'm going to add another bar. Don't spend your health chasing wealth so that you then have to spend your wealth chasing your health. You know what I'm saying? You never get it back.
Yes, sir. And like another topic that I noticed in your book, you know, you were in a good position, a great position, but you were overlooked for a promotion. So you went and got hired at Goldman Sachs. And then you said, okay, I'm out of here. You know, you were feeling swagged out. Like, yeah, see, y'all should have gave me that. I told you I'm on my way now. But I see that in a lot of jobs where, you know, you'll see someone, they'll be like right under the corporate status. And then every time they apply, you're like, they never get it. They never get it. And then next thing you know, they're out of there getting, a corporate position at a different company. So that leads to my next question, because I feel like the way I was raised, you know, you go to school, you get a good job. If you get one of those high end positions, you stay in that for 30 years, regardless, you know, long as that money's right, you're taking care of the family, you have everything you need, just, you know, suck it up and do it. But I'm noticing these days you're seeing, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs now where they're saying, you know what, that job was great, the benefits were great, but it was causing me some health issues where, you know, like the guy we had on the show last week, this brother said that when he would go to work, he would carry his resignation letter in his briefcase every day. That gave him a source of empowerment.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the differences in an African-American etiquette as far as how we were raised. So like I said, I was raised, you get that job, stay in that job 30 years, you get them benefits, you get that pension, and you just suck it up.
Yeah, you know, I respect the elders for how they raised us, but we also have to understand we're in an entirely different cultural context now than where they were. Back when they were coming up, back when they were schooling us, the idea of being at a single company for 30 years was a normal thing, right? There was a time in American history from a corporate standpoint where mass layoffs were like a scandalous thing. Companies never did mass layoffs. Now you're liable to, you know, open up the Wall Street Journal and see, oh, Morgan Stanley, I think they just laid off up to 2,000 people. The federal government, Human Health Services, they're about to cut 10,000 jobs. Right. You know, you and I are running same age. So we started our careers around the start of the global financial crisis and people were losing their jobs. So the idea of landing a job at a company and staying there for decades, that just doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, it's important for talent to navigate the marketplace with the understanding of I have to live with a sense of ambiguity. This job that I'm in, it's not permanent. And I have to be prepared. I have to be nimble. The other piece is we're now in a time where I actually think, in spite of all of the things that are happening right now in our society, I don't think there's ever been a better time to be young and talented and Black, right? And, you know, I think it's important that we operate from a mindset of optimism. And so with that said, you have the luxury, I think, nowadays of trying to really get in tune with what are my core motivations in life? What are those things that I do that make me feel like I'm coming alive? What type of work can I do that I love so much that I can lose track of time while I'm in that work, right? We have a bit of a freedom now to pursue work that helps us to tap into our genius. I am not interested in doing any work at this point in life that is not aligned with my core motivations and how I want to contribute to the world and every day. I'm not interested in doing work that forces me to play a different position, right? To give you a basketball analogy, I might be a small forward. I don't want to play power forward. I'm not going to do a job that requires me to do that. Like, you have to operate with the idea of finding that place for yourself that enables you to be who it is that you want to be professionally. Because only then are you going to do your best work. And only then that best work is going to result in you making the type of money that you want to make.
Great information. And, you know, speaking of money, a lot of brothers, you know, hey, man, I just want to get a seat at the table. But then, you know, I have a lot of friends and there's been a lot of guests on our show that are in C-suites. And, you know, I asked them, how are you comfortable being at the table and you're the only brother there? And what I noticed in your book, you said you have to be comfortable in those situations. So let's expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, there's a whole chapter on fitting into corporate culture. And I wanted to use that chapter to explain to people what corporate culture is and how did it originate as to how we understand it now. And just giving you the financial services sector as an example. So we're in the year 2025. Let's go back in time to the 1950s, right? What did corporate America look like? What did the large investment banks look like back in the 1950s? These were places that were run by white men. These were places that were run by white men that were at the upper end of the socioeconomic strata in our country. And we were banned from working in these places. Many of these firms, they didn't hire Black people. They didn't hire women. They didn't hire Jewish people. They didn't hire Asian Americans. So they established their cultures. Then let's fast forward another 20 years. Richard Nixon gets into office. The civil rights movement has already happened. It's already occurred. And they pass equal employment opportunity legislation. The doors to corporate America, the doors to these financial services firms, they start to open up to Black people. They start to open up to women. They start to open up to Jewish people and other minorities. And so we get our foot in the door. You're stepping into a corporate culture that you have to contort yourself to fit into. You have to speak a certain way. You have to speak according to how they speak, right? You have to dress according to how they dress. And look, I'm all for professionalism. There's nothing wrong with that. But the reality also is that there were a lot of financial services firms that didn't hire Black people well into the 1990s, right? So we're stepping into these corporate cultures, and there's certain things that we have to get comfortable with if we're going to survive in these corporate cultures. You know, everybody has to assimilate to fit into corporate America. But when you're a person of color, when you're Black male, I'm 6'2", 185 pounds. I'm, you know, tall, slim, but I'm on the larger side with a little bit of facial hair, right? I have a little bit of a baritone in my voice. We live in a society where Black men are perceived as larger and more threatening than their white peers, right? I talk about a study in the book where if you send in a resume and you had the name Jamal on that resume, you were perceived differently than somebody who had the name Connor or Garrett on their resume, right? So we're coming into these places, you know, with the knowledge that we have to make people feel safe around us. We have to use charm. We have to repress negative emotions to an extent. And that can be a corrosive type of a thing. And so what I'm trying to do with this book is equip us to get comfortable being in those seats, because there's nuances to it. And it doesn't come easy. It took me nearly 20 years of experience to finally reach that place of, okay, I can fully be myself within this culture.
Gotcha. Yeah, man. Because I remember, I'm going to take it back a little bit. I remember one time, so I called my mom. Me and my mom had a mean argument that morning. Boy, you better wash these dishes, make that bed. Da-da-da-da-da. So I called my mom at work. like, "Hey, I have everything done." She's like, "Hello, Corey. How are you? Oh, you have everything finished? You did?" I was like, "Mom, why are you talking like that?" So then after a while, she was like, "You know, I have to get off this phone. Let me get back to work." But when she got home, I was like, "Why are you talking like that?" And she was like, "This is how I have to talk in my professional setting." But the way that she educated me with that was, when you're around your friends, you talk, you use the slang, whatever. But when you're around your teachers, when you're applying for a job, you don't sound white, you sound professional. That's the way I was taught. You know what I mean? Because I hear a lot of people saying, "Man, why you sound white?" But I'm like, no, I'm sounding educated and professional. So let's talk about that a little bit. Because I do hear brothers saying, when they go to work, they kind of have to totally switch it up.
Code switch, right? And yeah, I wanted to really get into why people code switch. And the reality is, and I cited a study from Harvard Business Review. The people from marginalized groups, they code switch because they want to be afforded the same level of respect that people from the racial majority are afforded. That's why you feel compelled to do that. And the reality that we've been living with is black people in this country for hundreds of years. W.E.B. Du Bois published The Souls of Black Folk in 1905. In 1905, W.E.B. Du Bois talked about how Black people, Black Americans, have to have a double-mindedness, right? You have this mind that is fully Black, right? That's something, we were forged in the fire of slavery and the African diaspora to come out as African Americans and Black Americans. We have this Black identity, but then we have this American identity, right? Every other ethnic group has been able to come into this country and assimilate, right? If you came from a European background, you come over here, you're white. And after a generation or two and your kids have grown up, you got grandkids, they're white, right? But for us, we still have the pigmentation of our skin. We are doing two jobs when we're in corporate America, brother. We are doing the job that they hired us to do. And then we're doing the other job, right? Putting on that act so that we can be afforded the same level of respect as our peers. And, there's a tax, there's a cost that comes to that. There's a cost. I talk about the same thing you described in the book. I describe it as my mom was wearing the vocal equivalent of a straitjacket, talking like that, right? What is that doing to you psychologically if you feel like you have to suppress who you are? And I'm not saying to come in there using slang and talking a certain way. Everybody, I think, to a certain extent, behaves a little bit differently when they're able to let their hair down and they're not operating within that context. But I think it was important in the book to really drive home the point of we're doing two jobs, and by definition, that means we're working twice as hard. And there's data showing that when you're doing that code switch every day, it burns you out. And that's part of the reason why we don't have the same retention rate as some of our peers. You got to stick around in these places so that you can build the equity and then you get opportunities to grow. So definitely important that we have that conversation about fitting into corporate culture and how to maintain your endurance while you're dealing with that.
Because on this show we talk about generational wealth. So when we're looking at a brother in a C-suite position, you're like, okay, you're definitely establishing generational wealth at a faster pace. So I look at that as, but then when we talk about the health of working in some of these positions, the stress and all, the not being able to let it out, versus holding your tongue. Because again, I was raised to, you pick your battles, but for the most part, just shut up and do the job. How much of an advantage or disadvantage do you have by speaking up?
I'm glad that you brought that up because when you work in corporate America, when you have any job, right? But when you're in corporate America, you have to have an understanding of when to fight a battle, right? You have to have an understanding of what is the hills that I'm going to die on. And you can't operate with fear. You can't operate in that game and not be playing to win that game. And you know, one of the reasons why Black leaders fail when they get into those big seats is because they stop trusting the things that got them into that seat. And I tell some stories in the book about when I've decided to take a stand and fight certain battles. And I'll tell you a quick story about that. So back in 2020, right before the pandemic hit, it was late January. And, you know, I'm VP of communications at a major firm. I'm handling communications for the CEO of a major firm. And, you know, we had a big activation that we were going to be doing at Disney World in March of 2020. So, and y'all remember what the world was like in March of 2020. So late January, I'm starting to see these headlines about a mysterious new virus that's coming out of China, a coronavirus. And, you know, one epidemiologist claimed that 70% of the world's population was going to be infected by this thing. So I'm like, I'm on the road a lot. I'm flying all over the country, flying all over the world, in fact, at that point. I'm like, okay, this is something I got to pay attention to because, you know, I got all this travel coming up. So we get into February, and now the coronavirus is starting to explode around the world. And I start asking my leadership team, hey, are we going to pull out of this thing that's happening at Disney? And they keep saying to me, nah, let's see what Disney says. Let's just hold off. Let's not do anything. All right, cool. Fair enough. We get into the late February, early March timeframe. At that point, the coronavirus had hit Italy. Italy was in lockdown mode. It was bad. It was decimating that country. And I'm saying to them again, more people are traveling to Disney World than any other place. That's one of the big connecting points in the entire globe. And we're supposed to be there in 2 weeks. Hey, are we going to pull out of this thing? You see what's happening in Italy? Nah, let's wait. Let's let them make that call. Then we get into March, and now all of a sudden, people in the United States are starting to get infected with this coronavirus thing. And there's questions about whether Trump is going to put the economy into a lockdown and shut things down. And hey, are we going to finally pull out of this thing? And nah, let's see what Disney does. At that point, Corey, I said, you know what? I'm not putting my life in these people's hands. I'm not putting the life of our CEO in these people's hands. So I'm going to pull out of this thing on behalf of this company, and I'll just dare them to do anything to me about it, right? I'm not asking them for permission to do the right thing and potentially protect lives. So I pull out of it, and I've never been screamed at in my life at work, bro. Never. I got screamed at by a senior level person. You don't have the right to do this, right? I got to protect the company's reputation. This wasn't right. My brother, the day that we were scheduled to be there, the country went into a lockdown. Every flight in the country was canceled. We would have been stuck in Orlando in limbo in a lockdown if I didn't make that decision. And it led to some tension between me and my superiors for a few weeks, but eventually it was forgotten. And within a year, I got a promotion. And I'd like to believe that, you know, having a bit of a backbone gave me a measure of respect in their eyes. And so I only bring up that example just to share with Black people who work in corporate America is that don't be so afraid of losing your job that you're afraid to do what's right. And you can't do it all the time. You can't fight every battle. You can't die on every hill. You only have but so many bullets to fire. But when that moment comes, in whatever form it takes, you can't operate scared. If you're playing scared, you've already lost.
Oh, man, that's great information, man. And let's before I let my brothers engage with you, I want to talk about workplace tension or just someone I need to, you know, I'm not feeling this. I may have this new assignment or they may have added a new role to my job. But in the back of your mind, you're like, well, certain companies are doing layoffs and things of that sort. So how do you, I'm not going to say conduct yourself, because I mean, if you're in corporate America, you know how to, you know, like, you know how to handle yourself, but I'm talking about, like, you know, what techniques would you recommend before brother even says anything, before they just, and blow up? What, like, are there any techniques that, you know, we can use? And then the other part of that question is, how much is too much?
Yeah, you know, that's a tough one, right? Because I've been in, you know, positions where you have a job, you're hired to do a certain type of a job, and then the company decides to do a big reorg, and then they change your remit, and then your job becomes something else. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, is this something that I really want to ride out, right? is this a change that I believe in? And it depends, your response to that situation, it does depend on what your personal circumstances are. We're operating right now in a very difficult environment for white collar workers, right? Hiring is kind of frozen across much of corporate America. There's a lot of layoffs actually happening right now. A lot of companies are in hiring freezes. The economy is in a very uncertain place. Many economists are putting our economy at a 50% risk of recession at this point. And you see what's happening from a global trade standpoint. So I say all that to say, if you're in an environment where it seems like hiring activity is high and stuff is happening at your work, at your job, and you say, you know what? Later for this, man. Let me go test the market. Let me see what's what. Let me see what's happening out there. You got to detect when you have leverage, and only then can you make those types of power moves. In the situation that you just described, though, maybe talent doesn't have leverage. And maybe at that point, you just say to yourself, you know what? I'm gonna play the long game. I'm gonna bide my time. I'm gonna roll with these changes. I'm gonna find a healthy outlet to vent my frustrations, right? You cannot repress negative emotions. You cannot internalize that. And I think it's important that we as Black men operate with the understanding that we gotta find spaces where we feel comfortable enough to be vulnerable. To let some of that steam out, because pressure bursts pipes, right? And if you're dealing with anger over something that's happening at your job, and you don't find a healthy release valve for that, that can put your health at risk. So I think it's important, if you feel like you're stuck in a negative situation at work and you can't get out right away, that's all right. I would say in a moment like that, that is the time to really double down on what can I do to strengthen this and this? And maybe that might be therapy to a certain extent. I almost certainly believe that physical activity, making sure that you're exercising that body 3 to 4 to even 5 times a week, becomes very important in that regard. But you got to find those tools and mechanisms to strengthen your mind. In times that are tough at work, it's not easy, and sometimes you can't just say, you know what, I quit.
And that brings up mental health. A lot of brothers, when we talk about therapy, then, man, I don't have time. I'm not paying somebody to air my problems out. But how important is therapy, especially when you're in a C-suite or corporate America gig?
Yeah, I think therapy is important regardless, but when you work in corporate America, and look, to your point, and to the point of the detractors, I'm not somebody that operates with the idea that I need a permanent therapist. I had to go to a therapist every single week, all 52 weeks out of the year. I don't do that personally, but I do lean on therapy as a resource in times when I do need it. And it's important that we as Black men recognize that I've identified three layers to our existence as human beings. Number one, there's the physical layer, right? You are a body. I am a body, right? And we have to do all the things. We got to put the right food into this body. We've got to drink enough water. We've got to make sure we're getting our checkups to make sure that this body is functioning right. Because you know what? If the body's not functioning right, none of this matters, right? If the body dies off, that's it. Got to maintain the body. Number two, the mental piece, right? We've got to maintain our mental health. We got to understand as Black people, you can't pray away everything, right? Mental health is a different thing than spiritual health. Making sure that this is okay, that you're not suffering from depression or you're not dealing with anxiety, because there's a direct tie-in between what's happening up here and what's going on in the body. So you got a physical layer of existence, you've got a mental layer. And then thirdly, there is that spiritual layer. And it might take different forms for different people. Some people might be going, they're into prayer and going to church. Other people might just be into meditation. Other people, the spiritual thing for them might be, you know what, I'm getting up with my friends. We're gonna play this golf every Sunday, right? But those are the three dimensions. And it's important that we make sure that all three of those are operating at optimal health. And certainly for me, I have sought therapy in times when life was dealing me massive changes, right? 2021, my daughter was entering this world just as my father was leaving it. So I was bringing in a baby. My father was dying. I got myself a therapist to get me through that time. 2016, my grandmother died. I had another child that was born. I had a new job. Those are three of the most stressful things that a person can go through. I got myself a therapist while I was, in that period of life. So I think it's important when things get heavy, therapy, in addition to prayer and all the spiritual stuff, but there's a distinction, right? Can't pray away everything.
Looking in your background as well, I noticed you also are a marketer. So how do you think like a marketer?
I'm also going to be launching a company, Men Digital Community, to have a space where we can be vulnerable with each other, where we can talk about the issues that we deal with at work, the tensions that we might be dealing with, the effects of work stress, on our bodies. I have a homeboy that was working at Anheuser-Busch InBev back during the Dylan Mulvaney controversy. So Dylan Mulvaney is the transgender influencer that Anheuser-Busch partnered with for a Bud Light campaign. One of my friends, he was in marketing, helped to build that out. And then Kid Rock organizes a boycott against Anheuser-Busch. And that boycott caused them to lose like $1 billion in sales. So my friend is caught up in all this and he goes to the doctor during this time. It's a young dude, he's not even 40 yet. And he's hitting the gym, he's working out, he's in good shape. But then he goes to the doctor. The doctor says, "Hey, listen, you can't live with your blood pressure this high. You can't survive with your blood pressure this high." And he was stunned because he felt good. That's a silent killer, right? You don't necessarily feel your blood pressure when it's high. You don't feel it. And he loses that job a few weeks after that doctor's appointment. And then after all that stress disappears from his life, his blood pressure goes back to normal. So that for me was just instructive. Like, okay, we got to make sure that we're just managing this stress right. And if the environment's not healthy for us, it's okay to also get out.
Great information. And speaking of that, that kind of leads to my next question. When is it time to say, okay, you know what? I've done this job. It's time for me to do something else, go somewhere else. Like, at what point is it time?
So for me, I operate on a 3-year clock with every role that I'm in. And some people might operate on a 2-year clock, but it's important to always have that mindset of evolution. If you're in a comfort zone at work, and I think it's okay to coast for a little bit in a job, but don't overdo it with that because the ground is always shifting beneath your feet. I think it's also important to continue to always develop new skills and understand that the future belongs to the people who maximize their skills and use them in creative ways. And if you stay in a job too long, you run the risk of atrophying in a certain respect. One of the things I love one of my personal mantras is, I always want to download some new software up here, right? We all have these smartphones and every few months they make us download the new operating system, right? We have to treat our brains in the same way. And when you take on a new job or a new project, a new assignment, that's a way of expanding what's going on in your mind. And look, there's certain jobs where that might not necessarily apply, right? If you're an airline pilot, I think they, operate a certain way. Maybe there's new planes that come onto the market, but generally the skill set stays the same. If you drive the New Jersey Transit, that skill set stays the same. But for those of us who are living in this knowledge economy, we always have to be downloading new information up here, especially now, right? Artificial intelligence is really changing the game. We're going to be living through a massive technological upheaval, and so I think it's important for us to stay nimble intellectually. The other thing, Corey, is if you stay in a job too long, you're underpaid, and it's important to operate almost of a mindset of an NBA player. Every 2 or 3 years, their contracts are up, and then they go out on the free agent market and they see what their market value is. They sign a new contract. And I think we have to have a similar mindset. You got to always know what your market value is out there. And you can get the bigger jumps in pay, maybe not in this job market, but you can get big jumps in pay when you change jobs. You got to have an open mind about that.
Ray Simmons calling out of Rockledge, Florida. What have you taken from all of that experience in regards to how it molds you into how to move in the markets and how to move in those type of corporate spaces. Like, have you taken anything away from each one of those areas and applied it somehow?
Absolutely. You know, and I'll tell you, I started my career as a journalist, and you know, I evolved into being a corporate communications and marketing professional. And for me, you know, one of the things I've done with this book is to just synthesize everything I've learned. And I wanted to package it for Black men, because I had yet to see a resource, a book that just spoke directly to us about, you know, how to maximize corporate life. And one of the things you'll see in this project is a lot of the insights in the book are universal. You know, taking away the chapters that are specific to our health or the nuances of fitting into corporate cultures of Black man, I think a lot of the stuff that, you know, I'm talking about in the book is universal. And I close out the book with a chapter on leaning into faith. And I'm not talking about religious faith, right? I'm talking about faith in yourself. And y'all are familiar with J.R. Smith, you know, LeBron's teammate with the Cavs, played with the Knicks. So I'm a Knicks fan. And look, J.R. Smith used to drive me nuts as a Knicks fan, right? I play ball. I'm a hooper. I was balling this morning before the pod. And, you know, in basketball, you get these dudes, the irrational confidence guy. He's taking all the shots. He thinks it's going in all the time. A dude like that can shoot you out of a game. J.R. Smith used to shoot my Knicks out of the game all the time when he was off. But as Black men in corporate America, I think we have to have a little bit of that J.R. Smith mindset. You have to be irrationally confident in yourself if you're a Black man working in corporate America, to the point of delusion to an extent. You got to know that you're the best. You have to psych yourself up to know that you belong at that table and that you earned your way there, because it's very easy. And I've been on the other side of that equation where you get into the seat, and this was early in my career. I had an internship at Bloomberg News, and you know, I go from running my college paper. I was the man when I was in college, like editor of the campus paper. I'm enterprising. I'm doing all this stuff. I get to Bloomberg, and I'm a scared wallflower, and I'm just like, you know, wide-eyed. I'm waiting for somebody to tell me what to do, and I wish I could go back in time and say, man, go ahead and write any feature story that you want to write. Like, get off the bench, even if they're not encouraging you. I had leaders there that they were not interested in, you know, developing me. I should have had confidence in myself to develop myself. And that's something it took me a little bit of time in corporate to learn. So I think the biggest thing I've taken away from all that time in corporate America is believe in yourself, faith in yourself.
How structured are you, being that you've worked at a vast amount of companies? Like, how can you just give me like a snapshot of how structured your day is? If you can go into any detail about that.
So on a micro standpoint, on a daily standpoint, I'll answer that on a micro standpoint, and I'm gonna answer that in just how my mindset is. So I block out the first part of my day for myself. You know, and I'm a married father of three kids, but the first thing I'm doing every day is investing in my body. I'm going to the gym at least four times a week. I'm going to the gym. And yeah, that's my time. You know, it's critical for us as Black men to gotta lift weights. It's important to lift weights. It's not just about looking good at the beach. I see you got a nice pool in your back. It's not just about looking nice at the pool, right, with your shirt off. It's also about, it helps to prevent all sorts of physical ailments that we can develop over time, right? Type 2 diabetes, right? If you're lifting weights, it makes your body more efficient in how it's using glucose. It's not just storing sugar, right? It's good for your cardiovascular system. It's good for your posture. You feel better about yourself. You feel better about yourself. You're going to show up better. You're going to do better work. So I work out, because then when I hit the office, I'm like, all right, yo, let's get it popping, right? So I got that energy. And So for me, it's critical to give the first fruits of my day to myself. Radical selfishness so that you could be selfless to other people, right? If I'm not taking care of me, I can't take care of my wife and my three babies. So that's number one. Other piece for me is I read everything. I am an expert in everything that's happening in my company. I'm reading every single document I can get my hands on. I don't want any information getting past me, you know, at work. And I feel the same way about the industry. I work in financial services. I want to know what's happening in finance. I want to know what's happening in a macroeconomic sense, what's happening in our environment from you know, geopolitical sense. I want to know what's happening with my New York Knicks. I want to know what's happening with the broader NBA. So the bottom line for me is first fruits of my day, give to myself, work out. I also put good food in there. You could cheat a little bit. It's important to have a cheat day, but nutrient-dense food, drink enough water, take care of this body. That's number one. The information that I'm pouring in is number two. And then, you know, you get on with your day and how your meetings happen to be structured. That's the micro, how I structure it. But on the macro level, brother, I'm going to tell you, I'm now in this phase of life where I am only pursuing positions. And Corey, I actually resigned from JP Morgan. My last day is May 3rd, brother, because it's time for me to evolve and do other stuff, right? Maybe I'm doing my book tour. I'm going back to school to get an executive master's in public administration. I'm actually taking a sabbatical from work for a year, brother. I've set things up in my life. I have diverse income streams that enable me to do that. But it's come time for me to download some new software up here, right? Because I realized I will only do jobs at this point in life that enable me to have a positive impact on the community I'm striving to serve, brother. And I'm getting another level of education to teach me about all of the different possibilities that are out there. I'm getting this education to give myself a little bit of a break. I've been on this rat race for a minute, 20 years. It's a long time. But there's still a lot of work road ahead, but it's halftime. That's how I'm kind of looking at it. So for me, I have to, you know, on that macro level, be serving my core motivations in life. What do I want to contribute to the world? And I want to serve my community. That's what I want to do.
Well, thank you, man. Excellent answer, man. And I'm sitting, I'm listening, and I'm taking notes here at the same time, man. And I'll be buying your book probably today. As well. So I don't have your book, man. Yeah, I got to show some love, man.
I appreciate you, man.
The easy question now, man. Are you enjoying yourself on Black Men Sundays?
Man, I'm enjoying myself on Black Men Sundays, brother.
Definitely. And where can we get this book, brother?
It's available at all the major retailers. So, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, definitely barnesandnoble.com. It, you know, if you listen to your books, you can get the audiobook from Audible or from Amazon. You know, enjoy it like a podcast. It's my voice. I'm narrating the book, but you can definitely get it as an audio, or you can get it from all your major retailers.
That's right. And it's called Company
Men. Company Men, a wellness guide for Black men in corporate America.
All right. That's what I'm talking about. And before I let you go, man, you said something when you were talking to Ray. You said your last day at JP is in May and you have income streams. So let's talk about, because we've had brothers on the show said they have seven streams of income. I have three streams. I'm working on getting them. So can you discuss the streams of income? Because there's a lot of brothers that are listening like, okay, I kind of want to take a sabbatical too.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't have the resources to do that. So let's talk about some of those income streams, if you don't mind sharing.
Well, I do have a real estate business that I'm running. So there's some strong cash flows from that. And then I'm the part owner of a marketing agency that's mature enough now, it's doing very well, and that affords me to step away, keep paying the bills, not going to have any drop off you know, in lifestyle, and just give me the flexibility to pursue, you know, I want to get some more education, man. And I've tried to run my life in such a way where I'm putting the pieces on the chessboard and I'm playing the long game. And I think it's important for us as Black men to, you know, stop and ask yourself, what's the type of life that I want for myself? Am I living the type of life that I want to live? Is the job that I'm doing enabling? Because, you know, your job is about your life. We spend most of our waking hours at work. You know, we live in a culture that prioritizes work, it prioritizes productivity, right? It prioritizes maximizing your human capital. And you want to make sure that you are making the type of moves that enable you to remind yourself, you are in control of your life. You are in control of your own destiny that does not belong to your company, right? They can reorg and they can lay people off and they can do whatever they want to maximize their fiduciary responsibilities. But you got to be doing the same thing for yourself. You know, you're the CEO of your life. You're the CEO of your health. And, you know, I've tried to maneuver in that type of way. And then I also have, I chose wisely when it came to picking a partner in life. Right. I thank God every day that he connected me to Annika Grant, you know, because the way she and I are able to maneuver as partners, it also affords me a level of flexibility. And, you know, even if you can't leave your job tomorrow, don't be discouraged by that. But definitely start with, like, you know, the big crazy idea. Right. What type of life do I want to live? What type of flexibility do I want in my life? And then just start to work backwards from there. We got to have a vision of our lives. And you know, one of the things that I have envisioned is multiple retirements. So I'm kind of looking at this as like a miniature first retirement, because the next iteration of how I work is going to be very different than what I've done for the first 20 years. And so for me, it's all about here. People perish without vision. So start there. I know that might sound a little bit vague. And in a practical sense, you know, I'm a big fan of single family real estate. I'm a big fan of having short-term rentals in markets that are in demand. I'm also a big fan of private equity. Couple things before we go, because this is all a wealth conversation as well. Wealth is really what enables you to live the life that you want. And, you know, for starters, I think at a basic level, if you work in corporate America, you have to be maxing out your 401k if you can afford to do that, right? It's free money. And if you start in your early to mid 20s, by the time you're my age, I'm 44 years old, you should be close to net worth millionaire or right, or a little bit over it, right? Just set that and forget that. The second thing that you got to do, and this isn't the most glamorous thing, is you got to build a solid stack of cash, right? My philosophy, I want to have a whole year's worth of living expenses. I want to have a solid nut of cash, six figures if you have to, but like build your cash, make that, stack that, figure out how to build that cushion for yourself. And then once you get that cushion, now you can start to get a little creative with your investing. Now you can start to think about, all right, let's get me a little bit of private equity. Let's get some diversified income streams going. So you got to play the long game, I think. And wherever you're at in that journey, those are some tips. Those are some rules of thumb that I've tried to live by. And, you know, it's afforded me a level of flexibility at this stage of life.
Great information, man. That's what I'm talking about, man. Justin Grant, man, we appreciate you. Appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on Black Man Sundays, my brother.
I appreciate you, man. It's a Black Man Sunday.